Nord versus the Wolf, Mr. Wykowski.
May it please the court. My name is Ron Wachikowski and I represent DeWolf Boberg and Associates in this case. DeWolf Boberg and Associates, or DBNA as we'll call them, is a management consulting company. In 1997, they performed a consulting project for Rexnord Corporation at their roller chain plant in Indianapolis. Rexnord alleged in its complaint in this case that DBNA had breached its contract with Rexnord in its performance of this consulting project and claimed damages at trial of $3,282,085. After a three-week trial, the jury found in favor of Rexnord, awarding $1,641,043 in damages, exactly one half of what Rexnord had claimed, rounded to the nearest dollar. The first of the issues that we have raised on appeal concerns whether seven damages exhibits should have been admitted into evidence over our objection. Rexnord relied on these damages exhibits as the basis for 75% of the $3.2 million that it requested from the jury. The other 25% concerned a claim for refund.
What are you seeking in the way of relief? Do you want a new trial on everything or just a new trial on damages?
As to the three of the issues, Your Honor, I think require a new trial as to everything. Second of the issues that we raised, I think, does not require a new trial as to everything. But the first issue with respect to the admission of these seven damages exhibits, I think in light of the general verdict that was rendered,
But you say they're damages exhibits. Why would that lead to a new trial on liability?
Because what plaintiff has alleged in this case is the breaching of a whole series of different promises. And we have no idea what findings, if any, the jury has made with respect to those breached promises. We know they found at least one. We don't know which one and what damages might be related to that. And consequently, we'd need to go back for a new trial you can't go back and ask the jury to determine damages without knowing what is the breach of the duty that was previously found. And the verdict that was rendered in this case doesn't give you that information. So our position is that it needs to be returned for a new trial as to everything.
Well, I thought you'd conceded that you owed them some of your feedback.
With respect to the second issue, Your Honor, what we conceded is that the evidence was sufficient at trial for the jury to find that they were entitled to a refund.
So there's no reason to retry that issue.
We don't know what the jury found with respect to that issue, Your Honor.
Well, you don't think they found that you do owe a refund?
All that we know that they did is they took the $3.2 million divided
by
two.
So you want a complete new trial, aren't you saying that?
That's correct, Your Honor. We want a complete new trial. And we think that that is warranted first by the erroneous admission of the seven damages exhibits. Those damages exhibits we objected to.
You make any argument that you're entitled to your entire fee?
At the trial, Your Honor, our argument to the jury was that Rexnord did not keep its end of the bargain, and therefore they were entitled to no refund at all. And so we were entitled to our entire fee. That's correct. As to the issue of the damages exhibits, there are seven of those, and just by way of illustration, we invite the court to consider Exhibit 34.
I don't understand your emphasis on the exhibits. I thought your argument was that this collateral benefits provision in the contract didn't create an enforceable right and therefore couldn't be a basis for any damages.
Well, the issue of the collateral benefits is one that arises in two ways in this case, Your Honor. It arises first as to the admissibility of the exhibits. Rexnord has made the argument in its briefs to this court that these exhibits may be admissible and relevant as it relates to these alleged collateral benefits. Our argument with respect to those is that they do not create any contractual duty. And I would like to alert the court to one omission in our reply brief. I indicated on page 4 of our reply brief that we had not raised this issue at the time of trial in objecting to the damages exhibits. In fact, prior to trial, when the issue was presented directly as it related to the claims of promises of collateral benefits, we did, in fact, present in writing by way of objection. In our defendant's objections to plaintiff's trial exhibit list, which is item number 126 on the designated items for the appellate record, we objected to one of the other damages exhibits that Rexnord had listed. This was a demonstrative exhibit that Rexnord had characterized as a chart showing broken promises relating to savings, departure from the project, refund, employee morale, customer service, throughput, scrap, project completion, date, and preventive maintenance. In a 3-page written submission to the trial court, we said that those claims as to promises were in fact not contractual duties arising under the contract for the same reasons that we presented to this court on appeal. So the issue was in fact presented in that context when Rexnord had in fact raised the issue or presented the argument that this damage exhibit related to these collateral benefits promised or referred to in the engagement letter. So the way in which these particular promises come into play as to our appellate issues is first on the exhibits. There's a whole myriad of broken promises that are alleged. Some of them, we submit, do not give rise to contractual duties for the reasons that they were predictions, not promises, but they were not sufficiently definite to be enforceable.
Yeah, you know, you gave that example of a prediction of future events that you said doesn't constitute a promise, where A sees a fireproofed house and says to B, this house will never burn down. But what if A says to B, I will build you a house that will never burn down? Is that a prediction or a promise?
First of all, that example that I presented is drawn directly from the restatement, I believe, Your Honor. As to whether it's a prediction or a promise, when a person says he will build a house that will never burn down, I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. I think it may depend on a lot of the other external facts and what kinds of guarantees.
If it is a promise, is A liable not only for a refund of the construction costs, but also for the foreseeable loss of these household goods items?
The hypothetical the court is presenting is if a builder says, I promise to build you a house that will never burn down, and it burns down, I presume that would be consequential damages from the breach of the promise, Your Honor, in that circumstance. I suspect that would be the case. These damages exhibits that we're dealing with here, for example, Exhibit 34B, is a list of 26 names of supervisors who were hired from January 1, 1997 through April of 1998, a period about 6 months after the project. The names are there. There was never, however, any evidence at trial, and none is cited by Rexnord on this appeal, that links those supervisors who were hired to any breach of an actual contractual duty.
Well, your argument, I take it, the only contractual undertaking you made was to save them $4 million a year, is that it?
No, Your Honor, that's not it. We contracted to perform a number of services in the course of this project. We contracted to do that on a timely basis. we contracted to refund the money if we didn't get the $4 million in savings. But we did not contract, I submit, to improve employee morale, that there was no contractual duty to do that. Because there are a whole myriad of things that could cause employee morale to decline. We weren't contractually bound to do that. That was in the nature of a prediction with no enforceable or defined means of enforcement. And so that doesn't give rise to a contractual duty and doesn't give rise to these damages claims.
That's your main argument, isn't it? What else is there?
Isn't your main argument that the terms on which Rexnard is claiming damages are too vague to be enforced?
Well, what is vague in this case is what is Rexnard's claim as to the breach of contractual duty. We've got all of your damages here. They were presented at trial simply as these occurred as a result of the project. There are certain things that are going to happen as a result of a project like this. One of the things that's going to happen is you're going to have some turnover, because
yeah.
Some people are not going to change.
Here's my problem. You cited some case law that related to the sale of goods, and it seems to me that when a contract is for services rather than goods, terms will necessarily be more vague. Because surely you can't be saying that subjective standards can never be used in a contract for services. Contracts often promise, for instance, that the work will be done to the buyer's satisfaction. Well, you know, what would be different about this?
I'm not suggesting that the standard is the same for a services contract as for a contract for the sale of goods, and I think...
Well, those are the cases that you cited to.
And I specifically said they don't specifically govern here because this isn't the sale of goods. But the basic standard that seems to be applied under Indiana law seems to be the same. That is, that it has to be sufficiently definite, so you've got some ascertainable standard to determine whether there's been a violation or not, whether there's been a breach or not. You've got some way of determining what the damages are that flow from that, and whether that is merely speculating or whether that is evidence of actual cause. And in this case, what we submit is that these items of evidence, these seven exhibits on which the jury clearly relied in reaching its verdict, should never have been admitted into evidence in the first place, and do not provide a sufficient basis as a matter of law to support the verdict that was entered.
Why can't the jury infer that you performed the contract so poorly that Rexnord incurred all sorts of extra expenses as angry employees left, production slowed, customers were fleeing?
Well, first of all, as to that specific hypothetical, Your Honor, what the evidence shows is that we had a system for measuring what the financial effects were of this project, and that showed that Rexnord gained by more than $1 million during the course of the project, not that it lost. With respect to whether there are specific costs incurred along the way, for example, there's turnover. That's part of the process of change. You have turnover. Just because you have that occurred doesn't mean it results, or it is the result of a breach of contractual duty.
Well, obviously, it seems to me that the jury believed that each party was partly responsible for those losses because it awarded Rexnard only half of what it asked.
Well, they apparently didn't find that all of the losses were sustained. It's simply divided by two, obviously. But in dividing by two, it clearly has found some of the damages that there was no causal link to a specific contractual or breach of a contractual duty that we submit it could not, under the law, have found based on exhibits that should not have been admitted. I see my time for this.
Okay, thank you. DeCasey?
Mm-hmm.
Let me start at the beginning and ask you, what is the contractual promise that you think DeWolf violated?
Your Honor, the contractual promise that they violated goes to the essence of the bargain.
You're not answering my question.
Yes, I am.
What is the promise?
The promise, Your Honor, is that they were to improve the fundamental aspect
okay,
of Rexnord's business
operation.
Okay,
now point to where in the contract it says they were to improve the fundamental aspect.
Your Honor, in the analysis and in the proposal to the analysis, they set out a detailed description of what they intend to do. The first thing they say is that they are going to engage in a concerted effort to upgrade the management systems and production culture at Rexnord Corporation. They then go on to say that they are going to establish management system upgrades for purposes of affecting every single aspect virtually of this operation. In particular, and very important for this case, a staffing requirements determination. They were supposed to assist Rexnord in helping Rexnord determine what the proper staffing level was for Rexnord's operation, given the amount of volume that it was getting out of that plant. The evidence in this case establishes that they did not do so. One of their own project managers testified that they completely took their eye off the ball of staffing requirements determinations in this case, and as a result, they had an improper balance of labor in this particular operation. There are numerous promises in the proposal section of the analysis to suggest that they are going to work with supervisors to make them effectively and in a I think the word was interpersonal way.
Okay, that's fine. Now, what if any reliance do you or do you claim that they promised collateral benefits in this sentence that begins, please note that we are not attempting to put a financial value on the many collateral benefits that will come about as a result of this program. Is that is that a contractual promise that you're relying on?
Your Honor, we do contend that that is a contractual promise. For purposes of this appeal, however, we do not believe that whether that statement rises to the level of a contractual promise or not resolves this appeal. Because we believe that what that statement shows, Your Honor, is the causal relationship that they say doesn't exist. In this very document, in a document that their chairman of the board called their Bible, they were telling my client what my client could get out of this project. And the standard for recovering consequential damages here is one of foreseeability, what the parties anticipated at the time they entered into the contract. This letter of engagement, whether it rises to the level of contractual duties or not, clearly suggests an understanding on their part that there is a cause and effect relationship between their services and very basic functions of our client's business operation.
Okay, but suppose that all the promises that you initially stated about setting up these management upgrades, well, suppose they had scrupulously honored all of those, and yet there was no improvement in employee morale. There's no reduction, but there's no improvement. Now, would you be able to obtain damages in that case?
Your Honor, I believe that that's an issue of causation, and in that case, if there was sufficient evidence
at trial. No, I'm not talking about causation. I'm saying all the other promises in the contract are fulfilled. Everything they undertook is fulfilled, except, and they save you $4 million, they improve customer service, but they don't improve employee morale. It doesn't get worse, but it doesn't get better. So my question is, would you be entitled to damages for their failing to deliver improved employee morale?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's wrong. That can't be right.
Well,
because they've said expressly, we can't put a financial value on things like that.
But what they're saying...
Improved employee morale depends a lot on the employees themselves and on Rexnord, and it's just not just on DeWolf's efforts.
And that's why I believe, Your Honor, ultimately at trial, the issue would be one of causation as to whether or not their services resulted in worsened employee morale or whether that was something
not
that
Rexnord worsened.
Did.
Look, I'm saying employee morale doesn't go down. It just doesn't get better.
Yes,
they do everything they undertook to do. They save you the $4 million, but they don't improve employee morale. And I understand you to be saying, which I find very unconvincing, that that would be a breach of contract, that somehow they have promised you that there will be improved morale, even though they don't control morale.
That is our claim, because what they said in their own contract...
This is not promissory language, this sentence about, please note that we're not attempting to put a financial value on the many collateral benefits. That doesn't sound like contractual undertaking to me.
Your Honor, in the proposal section of the analysis, they said that they were going to work with our supervisor.
Yes, and I'm assuming they work with your people, they do everything they undertook to do, but they do not succeed in improving employee morale. Now, you seem to be arguing that this is one of these contractual undertakings where they're promising something that's beyond their control that they can't control. That's possible. That's, you know, that'd be insurance. It just doesn't look like that to me, especially with a sentence about we're not trying to put a financial value on these collateral benefits. I think it's overreaching to argue that this is the source of this is an that this is an independent source of damages here.
Your Honor, we do believe that it is a source, but we do not believe that it is the only source. There
but
are.
How do we know how the jury may have thought, oh, wow, it's the collateral benefits. That's what they failed to deliver, and then maybe that's a chunk of that $1,600,000 damages.
But, Your Honor, I think that when looking at this project, which was intended to improve the fundamental aspects of my client's operation, and wreak a great number of changes in that operation. Employee morale was integral to the project. And the reason it's in this letter of engagement is because my client would have had a concern, as all clients would. If you're going to come in and try to tell my people what to do, I want to make sure that it's not going to harm my client's culture. It's not going to harm our employees' morale. It was an integral part of this particular engagement because had they come
but
in...
But there's a difference between not harming and improving. And it's one thing for them to say, yes, if we damage employee morale, that would be a breach of contract. It's another thing to say that failure to improve morale is also a breach of contract.
Well, Your Honor, we would believe that this particular language in the letter of engagement is unequivocal in that respect.
How is it to be measured?
Well, Your Honor, we believe that it can be measured by what happened at the plant, in particular the amount of turnover. The evidence in the case from the senior Rexnord people is that one of the relationships to employee morale is turnover. It's clearly measured by turnover. In this case, 60% supervisory turnover in this 1 year compared to 0% supervisory turnover in the year before. Substantial amount of the turnover in the employees, 178 different job changes just within the period of time that they were there.
Suppose there were no decrease in employee morale, but no improvement. Then how? Then following up on Judge Kenney's question, how would the damages be computed? They had failed to improve employee morale. Now how would a court value that?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the court could value it much like the court did here. If you had the same number, for example, if you had the same amount of turnover that our client experienced in this case, 60% supervisory turnover, that's one measure.
Okay, now suppose that the turnover rate does not change. Now how would you compute damages for the fact that it hadn't been reduced?
I would agree with you, Your Honor, that it would be difficult to determine whether employee morale diminished or not.
No. Suppose it's conceded that it didn't improve and it didn't change. It just didn't change. Now, you regard that as a breach of contract, because if it didn't change, it means it didn't improve. Now, how would you prove damages for failure to improve morale?
Well, you're basically telling me, Your Honor, I don't have any damages because there's no turnover.
No, I'm asking you. No, look.
Maybe in that case, there may not be damages, Your Honor. You may be absolutely right.
But
there may not be damages.
Wait a second. You say that they promised to improve employee morale. But you're now acknowledging that that promise was unenforceable because there's no way to figure out to measure the improvement that they undertook to make.
No, Your Honor, that's not my point at all. I was responding to the hypothetical that was raised by the court. I believe that there's clear methods and ways of measuring employee morale. One way, for example, is when you see 50% of your employees show up to work.
Look, answer my question. Suppose everybody agrees there was no change in employee morale. No change. Will you take that as a premise?
Yes, Your Honor.
No change. That means no improvement. No improvement, on your theory, is a breach of contract. Now, how is that breach of contract to be valued by a court?
Your Honor, I believe that one would have to take a look at what the effect was on the workforce.
No effect, don't you understand? No change in employee morale, which means there was no improvement. But you say they promised improvement. So if they don't improve it, they don't make it worse, they just don't improve it, how does the court determine what your damages are?
It seems, given your hypothetical, Your Honor, that there would not be any damages with respect to that particular promise in that case. There may have been a breach of contract because it could not be measured in that particular hypothetical, because employee morale did not increase or decrease, but that's not our case. Our case is much different than that.
Sure, but it's completely unrelated to this undertaking to improve morale. Your complaint is not that they failed to improve morale, but that they made it worse.
That's correct.
And that doesn't have anything to do with this. This is about a promise to make it better. It's not about what liability they assume for making it worse.
Your Honor, employee morale was one of the promises in the letter of engagement. The prior point in the letter of engagement, as well as all of the promises in the analysis section of the proposal, clearly go toward their promise to improve productivity at this plant. And to improve productivity at the plant means that you have to improve the labor function of the plant and the output function of the plant. And all the damages that we have, what Your Honor is talking about is one set of our damages. It may very well be that the jury agreed with you, Your Honor, and decided that we aren't entitled to those damages, but they still have enough damages, given the other damages that we've asked for in this case, to grant us one half of what we sought, or $1.62 million approximately. And as a result, and the jury looks at this through 3 weeks of trial and hears all of this evidence with respect to all of these various promises to improve throughput, meaning get more chain out the door, and to improve productivity. Those aren't these collateral benefits. Those are up in the letter of engagement. That's the essence of the bargain that my client bargained for when it agreed to pay them $1.32 million at the outset of this project. And they did that because they thought they were going to get long-standing, sustainable business improvements, not transitory savings. Now, Your Honor, one final point with respect to the arguments that are being made today on these collateral promises, and I'd like, if Your Honors are going to consider that issue, we would ask that you also consider the practical effect of that argument, which is that, unlike the sales talk and puffery situations that they talked about, they reduced these to writing. They did it at a time when they wanted $1.32 million of our clients' money. They did it at the outset of the project. And compare what they said now in this letter to what they're saying now on appeal, which is that, well, sure, we might have said that to you back then, okay, but you didn't really think that we were going to have to do what we said we would do. Well, that, Your Honor, I believe, is the underlying current of this appeal, avoiding promises that they say to all their customers, what holds us out from everybody else. We stand behind the promises that we make. The underlying current of this appeal is that they do not. In response to one of Judge Rovner's questions with respect to the restatement of contracts, Your Honor, I believe that your question comes right out of another comment within that same restatement. And in that comment, it is quite clear that if someone promises that they are going to build you a house that is fireproofed, that is a promised result that is enforceable.
Okay, thank you,
thank
Mr.
you very Casey. Much.
Mr. Bartoszkowski, 1 minute.
Very briefly, Your Honor. I think I made clear at the outset. BB&A acknowledges it made a promise of a result with respect to the $4 million in savings. It didn't achieve that.
Well, you acknowledge you made a bunch of other promises.
We made other promises with respect to the services we would perform.
And they say you didn't provide them, and all these are the damages that flow naturally from them.
But that's what they didn't prove. They didn't prove that those flowed naturally from them. Exhibit 34D.
What's an example of what they failed to prove? I don't understand.
Exhibit 34D is an exhibit that has the purported severance of seven people who departed the company during the course of this project. There was no evidence that these seven people departed in any way because we breached a contractual duty. Two of these people, there was evidence that we recommended that they depart because they wouldn't accommodate to the changes that were made.
Well, why can't a jury consider that? I don't see why that's a big deal. Why is that a matter of admissibility? You and the Rexnard have different theories as to why these people left. So.
But the law requires that there be proof of some connection, of some causal link between the breach of the duty.
Yeah, but not every exhibit has to have the proof. It can just be a link in an argument.
When it comes to damages,
if you had to pick out one document that shouldn't have been, what's the worst that shouldn't have been admitted?
Frankly, Your Honor, I think all 34A through 34G qualify fully because with respect to none of them was this causal link established to any contractual duty that we had, to any breach of an actual contractual duty that we had. They list names in 34B. They list severance in 34D. No proof that those folks in any way left or were replaced because we didn't do something we were obliged to do. And according to the judgment.
Okay, thank you very much. Next case for argument.